These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University. Welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, thinking about Black internationalism through Palu's diaspora with Keto Swan. Africa World Now Project is next. As we have explored in previous programs, in fact, as we have attempted to unpack in every program, Black internationalism is an intentional disruption, a radical intervention in the global terms of order. In order to understand Black internationalism as a critical disruption, a radical intervention, we must unpack it. The concept international, as understood in dominant discourse, as opposed to discourses on the periphery, discourses from below, is related to the creation and force and position of the nation state, birthed from a European historiography and historicity as the dominant mechanism that organizes human life. The imposition of mechanisms such as colonialism and chattel slavery, for instance, rooted in a specific epistemology, was necessary to structure institutions and ways of knowing that reconceptualized what it means to be human as the justification for and maintenance of the idea of private property. Being so, international indicates a relationship at various levels of communities of people across artificial boundaries. It is from here Black internationalism then is understood as a radical disruption of these systems and institutions. It is a critical intervention in ways of knowing. What must not be lost in this praxis is the fact that this radical disruption is simultaneously a clear articulation and theorization of Black power. Cedric Robinson asserts, if we are to survive, we must take nothing which is dead and choose wisely among the dying. This assertion is certainly true on many levels, but requires a simultaneously developed alternative foundation to build upon, as the wise choices must be planted into something. Today, we explore the ideas and arguments in Palu's diaspora, Black internationalism and environmental justice, as presented by Keto Swan. Properly situated, we can see Palu's diaspora, Black internationalism and environmental justice presents a framework for that alternative, the possibilities of inventing the future. Palu's diaspora is a mapping of Black internationalism across the Atlantic, Indian, and Oceanic worlds through the life and work of 20th century radical Palu Kamara-Kafego. In this work, Dr. Keto Swan is disrupting and challenging limited conceptualizations and understanding of Black power by situating it properly in an international context, a Black international context. Dr. Swan offers us a map on how Palu was following in the long tradition of those who came before, a genealogy of Black internationalism's praxis of resistance. Keto Swan is a professor of Africana Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, where he directs the William Monroe Trotter Institute for the Study of Black Culture. He is a historian of Black internationalism, global Black power, and the Black Pacific. Dr. Swan is author of many articles as well as The Struggle for Decolonization, Black Power, and Bermuda. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land, for the benefit of all people. Enjoy the program. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Kito Swan. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing great, James. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man, no problem, man. And as you know, we've talked over the years about, you know, your work mm-hmm. and shared ideas and had plenty of conversation as being connected to Howard and through other things that we have done, mm-hmm. you know, this work, as we talked about a little bit offline, this work has been in a long time making. But it's also connected to a lot of the other work, but also to a grander scheme or to a grand strategy that I think that is going on, particularly in your mind, but also in your practice, right, in your scholarship. And before we kind of get to that particular grand strategy, is that let's set this term of engagement today, and let's talk about this work in connection with your first work. And you know, your first work, and of course we're talking about your current work, Palu's Diaspora, but also this is connected to your first work, Black Power in Bermuda, The Struggle for Decolonization. And I think this is an important and central practice to always map our genealogies, map our histories, because a lot of people may take, right. you know, certain points or certain ideas and think that they just discovered Kito Swan's work, right? Just discovered, you know, Palu's Diaspora, and they say, "Oh, you know, we just discovered, you know, Dr. Kito Swan. You know, he's a newcomer to this." But no, Dr. Kito Swan has been thinking about this for a long particular time, and I think it's important to map a genealogy, right? So, you know, and just to give a little teaser of this grand scheme or this grand strategy is that, you know, what you're doing is situating, you know, an academic field, this idea of a Black Power Studies or Black Internationalism, and you're really moving it through the African diaspora, Pan-Africanism, decolonization, and really situating it back into its proper context. And what I would say is this context is a praxis of resistance. Could you talk a little bit about the origins of this current work being birthed not only in your own personal interactions with the subject of this current work, but also the ideas that you are literally kind of mapping out in your first work? And again, before I read it, your first work is The Black Power in Bermuda, The Struggle for Decolonization, and it will move into this current work. Could you talk a little bit about how that first work set the terms of engagement for this work?
That's a great intro, and I definitely want to hear about this master structure that you see, right? Because, you know, you're absolutely correct. The book is positioned, it also is positioned for the next project that is part of another growth, but also some of it is returned to the source. The next project, which will come out this year as well, is titled Pacifica Black, and it's about Oceania and the Black International. And which looks at, you know, Pacific liberation struggles and Black internationalism more broadly, as, you know, Palu's Diaspora is centered on a Black Power Pan-Africanist ecological engineer from Bermuda who travels the world in different hats and connects the global South to revolutionary struggle and a practice of what I would say ecological decolonization. Palu is a really important figure in Bermuda's Black Power movement. He calls the first International Black Power Conference of Bermuda in 1969, which is, I do talk about that a lot in the first book. As you know, I've talked about on your show, the British, Canadian, US governments try to suppress that conference. Palu, in the process, becomes really endeared to the Black youth of the island, specifically a group called the Black Parade Cadre. And so I talk about Paulu in the context of Black Power in Bermuda, and I kind of leave off this moment where he is invited to Australia by a group, the Aborigines Advancement League, who they're building their own Black Power movement. And it's pretty much acts who come give some insight. And so in many ways, Paulo's diaspora jumps off from that moment. But at the same time, it jumps back too. Because Paulo's work in Bermuda, you know, by the time as a Black Power activist, in the 1950s, or early 60s, he was involved in Bermuda struggle for, you know, decolonization and also voting rights and universal adult suffrage, which, you know, voting practices in Bermuda were highly racist. Bermuda's Black majority was disenfranchised. And he was also involved in some of these early efforts to, you know, he helps he's the father of universal adult suffrage in Bermuda. But I encounter him, I engage him as a Black Power activist. But when I meet Paulo, you know, physically, it's, you know, mid-90s. You know, I'm coming out of FAMU, you know, big up to Florida A&M University, Rattler for life. And, you know, I'm at the time, you know, I'm saying me, but I'm talking about a generation. We're trying to find our way, right? Some of us are looking at Rastas Avenue, some is the Afrocentric movement, some is Nation of Islam, some, you know, Communist Party or versions of Black Marxism. We're trying to find our way. For some is Capoeira, or for some is African dance companies. We're trying to find our way as young people. And so in the part of that process, we're reading a broad range of books. So, you know, I'm in Bermuda, fresh out of college, reading Rasta and Resistance. You know, Walter Rodney's Groundlings is really important. And I meet Paulo. You know, I'm reading Black Jacobins, and C.L.R. James. And I meet Paulo. I'm invited to the house of a Black Power activist, former Black Power activist, name is Michelle Caldoun. And she says, I need you to meet somebody. And I meet this brother who's, you know, the quietest person in the room, but he knows everybody in the books I'm reading on a first name basis. He knows Rodney. He wrote with James for decades. James is his mentor. You know, he's traveled the world. You know, he's traveled to East Africa, West Africa. He's traveled to the Pacific, you know. And he can talk about Black people in the Pacific. For me, this is something I'm seeing in a Ranuka Rashidi lecture about Aborigines in Australia. Paulo is someone who's traveled these places for decades. He knows Yoffa Menyakinen, and he just becomes this fountain of information about the Black world, Bermuda's local struggles. And I'm sitting there, decided to go back to grad school. I want to study the African diaspora at a Black institution. At the time, Howard University had the only PhD program, African diaspora studies. But I didn't know what I was going to do. There was going to be Garvey in Bermuda or the Black Power movement. Paulo has me driving him around the island, doing political work, doing things that we're not interested in doing. I mean, I'm just taking this brother around wherever he wants to go, you know, but his feeding of information, so I love it. Well, on a hill one day, he says, stop the car. He says, you see that building over the hill? He points to this building, like that we can only see because on top of this big hill. He said, that used to be where the UNIA had one of its bakeries. And that moment was when I said, you know what? I'm going to study the UNIA in Bermuda as my master's thesis, and I'll do Black Power in Bermuda as my dissertation. So Paulo, in a very direct way, actually directed me towards my work as a graduate student. At the time, if you had asked me, was I going to write a book about Paulo, I would have said, there's no way. There's no way I could even take on something so grand. My view was very myopic. In hindsight, I didn't even know the value of what I was doing. I was trying to tell a local story to inspire a local community to fight for Black liberation in our community. That was the scope of my thinking. Paulo radically changes that. So to answer the question in a long-winded way, Paulo is there academically as well as politically and socially in terms of my development as a Black scholar trying to do work that matters for Black communities.
And for me, that's part of that grand strategy of rescuing what has come to be termed in many academic circles, this notion of Black Power studies, but also really unpacking this notion of Black internationalism, because this is an area that I look at consistently. An area that I, as you know, we talk about this. We've talked about this over the years. The last conversation that we had when we were passing each other was really actually about the Bandung Conference, right?
Yes.
You know, because I was trying to move that into some of the work that I was doing, you know, at the time, and that was a few years ago. And again, we were able to catch up before now, and you know, and understand that we face similar types of challenges. But part of that grand strategy is really kind of unpacking this notion of Black internationalism, because in vogue, and we have to be clear about, you know, folk who are studying, but also folk who are studying for use in liberation practices, right? You know, so to me, what you're doing is trying to really unpack and break away this notion that has really moved into academic circles and really talk in circles, right? This notion of Black Power. I guess I had to go straight to the grand strategy, what I see that you're doing. But this goes important, because this goes into, you led right to my next idea, my question that popped out to me as I was looking through, reading through your work. You're making a few arguments in your current work, right? But one of the important that I think is particularly interesting is what you're doing is really mapping this idea of Black Power through praxis, right? Through Palu, right? And what you just explained to me is how those ideas take root and then move out through the different forms throughout the diaspora, right? Could you talk a little bit about the relationship, the relationships that Palu shared with you, and how it developed his intellectual and political activity, and how that filtered into yourself, right? It filtered into you becoming an academic, but also a person who is really centered on a critical consciousness, a critical pedagogy, that you're not just teaching just to teach, or you're not just writing just to write. Could you talk a little bit about some of the relationships? For example, C.L.R. James, for example, you know, the UN, the UNIA. Could you talk a little bit about how that was very important, not only for Palu, right, but also how that filtered it? So, because you're mapping an idea through a praxis. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, great question, great comment. So Paulu meets C.L.R. James as a really young person in Bermuda. It's these are stories, right? These are stories, and when you listen to the stories, beyond the academic frameworks, it's really about how people relate to people. And so my practice becomes about building relationships than just what's on paper. Because it's the relationships that actually create the stories. So, and what I mean by that is, and that lead us to the political stories, right? That we're gonna talk about, but they're based upon how people actually live their lives. So Paulu's family, his father's from St. Kitts, his mother's from Nevis. So he comes from small islands, but in Bermuda context of big islands, his family migrates to Bermuda in a period of West Indian migration around the turn of the 20th century. And what I was trying to do in the book, which was, you know, a little maybe overly ambitious, but that's the type of scholarship that I want to focus on. I want to take risks. Was that each chapter would give us something about the diaspora world. And if folks only read one chapter, they get something transformative and some type of tool to look at the Black world differently. So what I was trying to demonstrate in the first chapter was Paulu's story was not just about him as this big man. That's not how he lived his life. So I tried to write about the communities he was connected with and put him in a conversation, put the communities in a conversation through him, showing that the Black world's connected in all these phenomenal ways that are sometimes not even intentional. Academics want to create frameworks that, in my opinion, are very intentional all the time. But that's not how life is. Everything's not intentional. Everything doesn't add up, right? It makes sense in the long run, but in the moment, sometimes things don't make sense. So usually when we think about West Indians traveling around the turn of the century, in our minds, they're going to the Panama Canal, Costa Rica, which are all true, right? They're going to London, check. They're going to Paris, check. They're ending up in Harlem. All of this is true. But we also have West Indians, and by West Indians, that's also a node for other diaspora communities that could be within the United States too. They're going to other small spaces. But the routes to get to those small spaces, I call them the mobile metropoles. They're temporary, but the train ride becomes a space of transformation, the boat rides, sometimes with small cities. So while we should look at Chicago and the rise of Black music in Harlem, African-American communities from small communities are going to a lot of places. Florida, for example. The point was, if we can study migration in small communities, using Bermuda as an example, we can take this model to other similar communities across the Black world. Long story short is this. Paulo's parents come to Bermuda, turn of the 20th century. He's in a very, raised in Bermuda, born in Bermuda, raised in Bermuda, a very West Indian-centered community. It's a household of cassava. It's a household of ackee and soulfish. It's a household of Bermuda's, peas and rice. And, the Southern Caribbean's rice and peas. It's all of that. It's ackee and soulfish, it's cuttlefish and potatoes. It's just amazing world that Bermuda has of Black Caribbean cultures. That's culturally speaking, but also in a political context, Bermuda is also very segregated. So when West Indians or when Black people travel to Bermuda, they cannot stay in white hotels. So they have to stay with other communities. C.L.R. James comes to Bermuda in the 1930s. He can't stay in a white hotel. He ends up staying at Paulo's home. So, and this hits off the friendship. Paulo ends up as a student at NYU, and he goes to C.L.R. James' talk at Abyssinian Baptist Church. And now the personal relationship also now becomes political, and James becomes a mentor for Paulo for pretty much the rest of his life. He cooks for James over the years. James invites him to Trinidad as a bodyguard, do letters. James opens the 69 Black Power Conference. But these are also due to the relationships. Now, what's important about this for me is Paulo would never define himself as a Marxist. He has a very strong socialist, Black socialist, African socialist view of the world. But he never defined himself as a Marxist. And in fact, he had a lot of disdain for white Marxists who still expressed their racism. So in other words, James and Paulo are rice and peas. James is, it's iconic, right? Black Marxist, Trotskyite, right? But for Paulo, even though there's a moment where the politics don't align, the relationship is so strong. And so that, to me, that speaks to the reality of Black people. The relationship matter more than the ideological thinking. There were a ton of other intersections that they were aligned with, but the personal relationships that build also, for me now, allows me to talk about why James is important to the Black Power movement. Why James, on one hand, could have a critique of Kwame Ture, but at the same time, Black Jacobins is being read by Black Power activists without question, because James is more than just Marxist Trotskyite ideas. He's an actual living veteran activist who is making himself available to Black Power activists at the moment. And for Paulo, that also gives Paulo something else. So for me, that's a way of saying, similarly, that's how Paulo would approach, my generation. I'll never forget the day I'm about to go to graduate school at Howard, and Paulo invites me to his home. It's me and two friends of mine, and it's like 6 a.m. You know, I have a flight later that day. He says, you got to come over to the house. And first thing we do, we go outside. There's some cassava growing. And he says, see that cassava right there? You know, it can also be a weapon. It could be a poison if you did it like this and boom, boom, boom. And we're talking about plants. Then he turns to me and he says, he looks me right in the eye and says, so you want to go study history? Like, what else are you going to take to Africa? Like, what other skill sets are you going to take? You're going to go to Africa and teach African history? He said, think about that. Like, you got to have something else. You got to think about, you need some praxis. You need something else. And whatever that else is, I don't know. But you should think about something else. And when you go to Howard, you have to, like, be the strongest. You got to be as strong as possible. Otherwise, don't waste your time. If you're not going to do something in the interest of being the best at it, don't even start it. And so that mattered to me. So the practice part for me was something that I knew I had to try to engage in. That's just the reality of the stories, right? This was Supaula was, right? He starts a conversation about political world by talking about a plant. But when we think of when Paulo would tell us stories of how he connected the world, one of his first questions he asked communities that he traveled to was, what do y'all eat? It's like the first question he would ask. You know, not even the political dynamics, like, what do you eat? Where do you get your food? You know, and for him, it was like, once you have a sense of that question, it tells you a whole lot of other political things that are going on. And even for myself, when I would start my diaspora classes, I usually started around some discussion of African foods as a way of unifying, you know, my classroom around certain foods that we all would eat. So the point is, Paulo's praxis has informed my work on so many levels. I appreciate the opportunity to even think through. Some of these things aren't really that conscious. They just become, you know, but there's a process. Like you said, you know, knowing this work right now, it's a process that got me to this point, I wasn't always able to even understand my master plan, quote unquote.
Your grand strategy.
My grand strategy, thank you. Yes, better phrasing. Yes, thank you.
But that goes into, because what we're really talking about in the context of not only being able to formulate or articulate ideas or map or trace ideas that folk read about in certain instances, whether they're institutionally connected or not, at the center of this is relationships and how this how these relationships birth ways of understanding the world, which is something that's rooted in a Africanness, a very African return to the source. And of course, we have to look at the context of Cabral, Amilcar Cabral, and the work that he was doing, because the similarities are very, very important. Could you talk a little bit about that, the similarities, the relationships, the interactions, that notion of returning to the source, and how Paulo understood that, but also he understood even more important is to transfer that to generationally, transfer that to you, because you're reaching multiple young folk, right? You have taught thousands of, you know, your undergrad students. You've impacted graduate students, right? You know, relationships outside of the institution and inside of the institution. Across institutions, across communities. So at the center of this, because you mentioned this notion of an African socialism and how these notions of Marxism can move and move in and out of Black radicalism, it's because it's really about the relationship that African people have to not only the universe, but also to the earth itself. Which, as you see, what we're moving to is Opalu's actual work, right? So could you talk a little bit about that, right? Talk a little bit about, pick one of those strands of thoughts and jump right in. Jump right in, Dr. Swan. Jump right in.
Well, I mean, it's phenomenal because Paulo meets Kwame Nkrumah.
Blues. Antique Blacks. Astro.
We are currently listening to a wide-ranging conversation where we are exploring Black internationalism through the praxis of Palu Kamara-Kafego, as presented by Dr. Kito Swan in his current work, Palu's Diaspora, Black Internationalism and Environmental Justice. Kito Swan is professor of Africana Studies at the University of Massachusetts Boston, where he directs the William Moreau Trotter Institute for the Study of Black Culture. He is a historian of Black internationalism, global Black power, and the Black Pacific. Dr. Swan is author of many articles as well as The Struggle for Decolonization, Black Power in Bermuda. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Continue to enjoy the program.
It's fresh. I've known rivers, other bodies, making giant steps.
STLR Jams is home in London. And that's important because Paulo is he is forced to leave NYU for denouncing, you know, segregation. And before he leaves, he meets a teacher named Maddie Pegsy, who actually was a home economics icon in South Carolina, Orangeburg. You know, she organized farm exhibitions and farm festivals. You know, if you look her up, but this is what Paulo does to you, right? He connects you in ways that you don't. He shows us how the Black world, because it's not him. He shows us how the Black world is connected through these unexpected ways, because he's always seeking more. He's always seeking that Black radicalism. And in Paulo's diaspora, he's going to always end up at the most radicalized spaces of Black communities, because that's just how he rolls. So he meets Maddie Pegsy. She says, well, you should come study at an HBCU. You know, I'm at South Carolina State College. You should come there. So from NYU, he goes to South Carolina State College. This is before the Orangeburg Massacre. So this part of the book was talking about South Carolina's activism, you know, in the 1950s, 1954, 55. But Paulo only goes to South Carolina College because he has this relationship with somebody he meets in the library. So this is not this is not intentional. But once he finds himself in South Carolina, he gets heavily involved in, you know, this cross-section, you know, resistance between the NAACP, Black sharecroppers, our students at Claflin College and South Carolina State College, NAACP lawyers, who are fighting against these white citizen councils, who are burning crosses all across Orangeburg. Paulo encourages students to arm themselves against Klan violence. He meets folks like Septima Clark. And this is once again, this is 54, 55. The NAACP is outlawed. You know, South Carolina branch is outlawed. Radical journalists like Modjeska Simpkins is involved in this process. And so there's this network of support coming to this local struggle that's all across the United States. Actually, I found letters in crisis where there were some farmers in Ecuador who were sending support to this local struggle, in which, you know, students are kicked off campuses, in which reverends like Joseph Delaney shoots back at the Klan. Delaney is this amazing, you know, revolutionary, you know, reverend, who says he's shot in the name of Jesus. You know, he puts a Klan member in the hospital, flees to New York, is outlawed in South Carolina. The governor has a warrant out for his arrest. He becomes a major figure in New York circles. But this is South Carolina. This is 1954, 1955. It's a ton of activism. Because of that, Paulo was also kicked out of South Carolina State College. He ends up in California at Pasadena State College. He meets a ton of folks from the African continent who he plays cricket with, i.e. James, and he also drums with. And there's a core of Kenyan scholars or Whoopi scholars who he meets. So why does it all matter? Well, make a long story short, after his time in Pasadena, he wants to go to Liberia. He has to flee Liberia because he's involved in a labor strike. He runs to Ghana. He knows he can go to Nkrumah's home because he knows Nkrumah through James from London. And also in Ghana, who was there, right? The Du Bois, Charlie Green Du Bois, WB Du Bois, that whole crew. Mm-hmm. Nkrumah says you should go to East Africa to help Kenya in its liberation struggle as about to be independent, which he does once he gets to Kenya. His introduction to Kenya life are these students that he played drums with and played cricket with in California who introduced him to Kenya. So his story always, there's always these interpersonal relationships that lead his geographies that make things possible. Even his time going to Liberia is because his wife actually is part of William Tubman's family. So he's always using these relationships to find Black radicalism. And in Kenya, he starts to really do his work around environmentalism and building water tanks and bamboo. But it's the structure of that is this relationship that allows him to, you know, exert his political views, which are always at the ground level, always.
Which is interesting, and let's piggyback on that point of really kind of laying the ground, particularly in Kenya. Let's pick up with that as a person who travels and takes students to Kenya consistently, who's built personal relationships with communities on the ground there. Myself, let's pick back up there in that particular, because again, we have to get out to the Pacific, right? We have to get into the Pacific areas as well. And, you know, we're not even halfway through this conversation yet. Because this, you know, this is very important, because when we're talking about mapping, when we talk about these histories, what you're doing, and it's something that I attempt to do as well, is how do we have a frame to look at this multiplicity, right? You know, because if you try to make sense of it, right? And that's the reason why, you know, particularly, you know, I have affinity with your work and, you know, followed you and looked at it over the years and very excited about this one and also the next work that you're going to do, because it's also what you're doing is really mapping out a genealogy for folk generations to come, particularly in this particular epoch where we have global environmental injustice that is directly rooted in racial capitalism that has deleterious impact on communities of color across the world, that connects to the Pacific, that connects to the Caribbean, and that also connects to South Carolina HBCUs as well. And I also wanted to make a note. I also wanted to make a quick note, because when you say he got kicked out of an HBCU, how appropriate, right?
Yes. Quite
because we could go through the hit. Anyway, but let's pick back up there. What is he doing? Again, I mean, I think it's important. And again, folk, get the book. You know, we're not going to talk about everything, but we really, what I wanted to do with this conversation is talk about the ideas. And you can read the book to get the details of how these ideas, these grand ideas that we're discussing, you know, that's how I wanted to approach this conversation. But talk about Kenya and how that propelled him to the work part, right? To the actual, like, technical contributions, the material contributions, because again, he's somebody who understands intellectual, and intellectual work has to come with work. Right?
Check.
You know, a connection with praxis. Talk a little bit about that and move out that way.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And this is why I love the stories. So in Kenya, as I mentioned, you know, some of the folks that he knows from California, this is 1950, when it's in California, this is 1958, right? This is 57 rather. It's that, so those students are going to be the first in the colonial, you know, post-colonial world. These are the first, right? These are going to be the first Kenyans to get these degrees, right? This is that, at least in the memory of a Europeanized version of, you know, expertise. Mm-hmm. It's the first for African people who are going back to build their nations.
Right.
So let's
pause right there, because that's a very important point. The first. Is an African, because it's ancient. We're really talking about ancient ideas, right?
Exactly. Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I had to interject real quick. Go ahead.
No, but that's important. I want to just stress that for the listening audience, that's in quotes. Okay, that's in quotes. Can't see my quotes. But yes, I'm making quotes.
So. We hear through the radio. We hear through the air.
So, when he goes back, right, the students are now, you know, these quote unquote first. So they have some sense of weight. You know, so he gets a job teaching at University of East Africa. You know, which at the time had satellite campuses also in Tanzania and Uganda. But at the time, it's University of East Africa. He also meets a core of African-American, you know, folks who return back to Africa, just like the Ghana context, right? There's a community in Nairobi that would include people like, you know, really critical players like Rustat Njeri, who, you know, is a heavyweight. She writes about education and decolonization in Kenya. African-American educator. She actually becomes director of Phelps Stokes programs years later, but she writes this phenomenal dissertation on Kenyan education. One of the things Kenya was trying to do was Africanize its civil servants, but also Africanize, and this is the language of Kenyatta's government, Africanize the education system and curriculums, including science. So one of Paulo's work is, you know, transforming, you know, the public school system science curriculum into African context. So we're not just talking about European weather patterns, right? Or European animals. You know, we're talking about African animals, African ecologies, foodways, climates. When we think about Africa, there's a lot of attention on what this looks like in terms of politics. But from a scientific perspective, what does look like? I don't think we really have a grasp of what that means. Paulo's, one of his mantras was, if we go independent, but our energy sources are still controlled by our colonizers, I'll be truly free. This is not just a political conversation, an economic conversation. From an energy standpoint, right? If the energy systems are still controlled by the former colonizers, I'll be truly free. If the technocrats are still European, if the ones who control your generators, they run your electricity, is that still fuel to Europe? We are not free. So he saw his contribution as always being political, but his work in ecology, but is also meeting folks like Joseph E. Harris, who's gonna found African Diaspora Studies. Harris and his family are in Kenya at this time. So Harris and Paulo formed this amazing relationship. And this also travels through decades. Harris is someone who's always feeding Paulo with information about the Black world and vice versa. Paulo was talking about Black people he met through his travel. So they have this amazing connection that actually helps me at Howard. Mm-hmm. It's time I don't know, but it's going to help me years later when I'm a grad student with Harris, this beast of diaspora who I'm actually afraid of because this guy knows the whole world.
Joseph Harris, right?
Joseph Harris.
Right?
Yes. Right. Yes. Right. Joseph E. Harris. Yes.
Yeah.
So in that context, Paulo starts doing work around building water tanks with bamboo. His first design was actually in Liberia. He refines his technique and writes his first manual on how to build water tanks from bamboo and a home from bamboo while he's in Kenya at this moment. That model, he's going to refine that and do actually a ton of projects, rural projects at the village level all across Oceania. Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu in particular. Actually, when I traveled throughout Oceania, I was able to see some of these water tanks he had built. At the University of Papua New Guinea, he built this model of what they call the model Melanesian home from bamboo and also from natural resources that were available to communities in these areas. That was much of his professional work. But it's in Kenya where he has this, I mean, we you know, sometimes we think of Africa, right? I mean, think of Africa continentally, which is important. But Kenya's in the Indian Ocean, right? We're in the Indian Ocean, we're not in the Atlantic. So when you look at the ocean, you're looking towards the Indian Ocean, you're looking towards Asia, you're looking towards the Pacific. So Paulo becomes part of this network of activists, engineers, and this is his diaspora, a political world of Black engineers who are not just Atlantic-based, that are also Pacific-based, and the lens is also going east of Africa. So folks from Mauritius, from the Comoros Islands, Andaman Islanders, these are folks who become part of Paulo's vocabulary. And when he talks about the Black world, he's always talking about there's a Black world in the Indian Ocean, there's a Black world in the Pacific. So when myself, I end up in places like, you know, Kemet, studying Arabic, when I meet Comoros Islanders, I know who they are in an abstract sense, because Paulo has already told me about these communities. Now I just want to know more. So he creates these, for me, Paulo becomes a really important conduit for the Black Pacific, you know, even a Black Indian Ocean, if we might say, that I don't think I would have had the same mapping. My mapping of the Black world would have been made much more challenging if I didn't have a conduit like Paulo, who had been a conduit for the Black world. I mean, he's literally has articles in the Black World magazine about the Black Pacific. And I know we're getting there, so I'll pause there, because maybe that's probably the next, I'll give you a chance to ask another question or comment.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, and you keep saying long story short, and we like the long stories, you know, but of course we want folk to, you know, again, you know, to read the details. And again, the conversation that we're having is really to map, you know, how do we map the details of ideas and how they form and developed, but also what is it that we're supposed to be taking from this? And it's something that you said, I mean, it's, again, it's someone who travels to Kenya, travels to the continent. Right. We talk about Africanized education. We have to be careful and see that there's an Africanization of colonization too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, there. But again, when you're talking about, again, your point that you're making, we're talking about ancient treks. When we look at diaspora, and of course, Harris has done a lot of work, because when he's in Nairobi, he actually does this conference that is there, yes, that kind of really, yes, sets the stages and the parameters in terms of engagement of an African diaspora. Absolutely. In Nairobi. Paulo's right there. Right. Not only do you have these ancient connections of the world, the Indian Ocean world there, of the Pacific world there, you know, a lot of Black people, because Black people are everywhere, and they'd be like, oh, Black people in the Pacific, of course, because there's ancient treks there, right?
Right.
So you have to read that history. But then to understand that what you're doing is linking that through a radical resistance through Paulo's diaspora. And I think that is important, your term, because it's looking out towards the East. Which is, again, moves there, right? So he moves there following these ancient or older treks or older migrations of African people throughout the region, but also how they move throughout the world as well. So it's very, so it's interesting, because it's almost like it's looking at a decolonization of a decolonization process, right? If you think about it in that particular, so he's mapping, he's moving back through time to bring forward these ideas at the same time interacting with it. Go ahead, jump in. You know, so
no. You're absolutely correct. Because in Kenya, you know, he's gonna meet Malcolm X. This is 64 during Malcolm's second trip. He actually met Malcolm in California as well. He meets Malcolm because Malcolm also gives a talk to this community of African Americans. And there's a core of these African American women, and their Kenyan husbands, and some of them are starting schools like the Ralph Bunford National School, which Paulo, you know, becomes headmaster, quote unquote, for. But it's also going back to Bermuda. This is early 1960s, and from early 1960s until late 1960s, this is in Africa in some degree. So it was in Africa when the Black Power Movement emerges. But it's been in Africa to see the process of decolonization. He's in Kenya before his independence. He's able to see, right, the tough work of nation building that you're mentioning. This Africanization of colonialist ideas is a problem. And so for him, he also sees the potential, but also the pitfalls for Fanon's national consciousness. He knows what that is. So his vocabulary of Black Power, which is coming, is going to also include his experience in Africa from a real perspective. It's not an abstract idea. Malcolm returns to the Americas, tells, you know, the Black Power working group of people like Chuck Stone about this Bermudian guy in Kenya doing his work. Paulo ends up at one of the Black Power conferences in Philadelphia in 1968. It suggested there should be a Black Power conference outside of the United States. Actually, that's Paulo's suggestion. It takes place in 69 in Bermuda, as mentioned. Is invited to go to Australia. Once again, you know, a radio host interviews Paulo about Black Power's relevance when a white Australian radio host interviews him about Black Power's relevance to Australia. He says, of course, you know, if you're pressing Black folks, of course it's relative. He's invited to Australia. Now, what's striking about this is Paulo is always thinking down the road, but not just about himself. So at the Black Power Conference, he talked to James, and it's part of the meeting that, is this not time for a 6th Pan-African Congress to take place? As we know, the 5th one in Manchester, 1945, it's been several years. James has been one of those persons there. He says, James, what do you think? James says, I like it, but you need to go talk to the old man. Old man is Kwame Nkrumah, who now is in Guinea, you know, to work Secret Touré. So Paulo is invited to Australia, but is also, and is also trying to have a Black Power Conference in Barbados as a follow-up to Bermuda's conference. That gets sabotaged. That becomes the Congress of African Peoples in Atlanta, 1970, which Paulo is actually going to invite Black Power activists as he meets in Australia to that Congress, which is a really important moment for Black internationalism. These are cutting-edge Black Power activists in the Pacific. And the Pacific lexicon are giants, people like Patricia Colwer, Bob Mazza. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Paulo, on his route to Australia, and for me this matters, he first travels to see the old man. He goes to Nkrumah, and then Nkrumah gives him the, says, yes, okay, this sounds great, I'm on board, but you need to go talk to Nyerere. Because you probably should have had this conference in Tanzania. It's probably the best place for this conference because of Nyerere's work around Pan-Africanism, and he controls the state. Like, I don't have that. And so despite, and this is important too, right? Because the way we remember, when we're talking about Pan-Africanism, in the classroom, it's Nkrumah here, one Africa, you know, Pan-Africanism, there's Nyerere, federated concept. But Nkrumah is quick to say, go to Nyerere. That's the best place to have this Pan-African Congress, which is how we get to six-pack in 1974. But this process starts in 69. This takes years. And for me, this is important because, and I think it's something we talked about years ago, when we look at a conference from just the start and date of it, we miss the significance, the possibilities, the networks that are formed before and after. It's a five-year process. Most scholars who look at six-pack, they focus on the two-week period in Tanzania. But there's a much broader lens. Long story short, there's a ton of folks going to see Nkrumah in Guinea. Ton of folks. We know Kwame Ture, and we know this is where he gets, you know, changed his name. But Paulo is there. Obi Agbuna, founder of, you know, the Black Panther Party in London, also visits Nkrumah. Nkrumah will record his, you know, message to Black people of Britain via Obi Agbuna. So once again, there's conversations between Nkrumah and Grace Lee Boggs and Shirley Green Du Bois. So for me, this is Paulo's diaspora. I'm looking for Paulo with Nkrumah in Guinea, but what else is there? Right? So then he travels to Tanzania. He gets the okay. From Tanzania, he stops in Madagascar. He stops in Reunion. He meets with activists, inviting folks to this Black Power Conference and also Six Pack. And from there, he goes to Australia. So the route is via Indian Ocean. So for me, the journey is, that matters, right? The mapping and how he gets. By the time he's got to Australia, he's already built, he's traveled across Africa. Funding by the community, right? This is not, you know, an institution-sponsored trip.
No grants.
Right. That's not right. Because he can't even get a job in Bermuda because of his politics. The white state won't hire him. So he gets packages from Bermuda's Black community of funds under the table. This is how he supports Southern Bermuda. He can't, this brother who has global, you know, experience cannot find a job in Bermuda, which speaks to Bob Marley's piece, right? Some, you know, good man, you know, never honored even his own yard. He gets to Australia. He works with this group, Aboriginal Advancement League, This is important for me because when we think about Australia, when we talk about Black Power, it's important that we're having these conversations, but we're looking at, when we think of Black Power globally, we're still looking for, in my opinion, Black Panther formations. So the Australian Black Panther Party is critical in Australia. There's no debate about that. But Australia is a vast space. It's not the only Black Power group. Melbourne is the major Black Power organization, is the Aboriginal Advancement League, who Paulo invites to Barbados. They end up in Atlanta in 1970. And that is a phenomenal moment for the story of Black Power globally.
No, absolutely. Because again, I mean, even if those who really take a very advanced or critical understanding of Pan-Africanism itself, and a lot of people try to look at Black internationalism, because Pan-Africanism itself is international, period. There is no debate.
Right. Right?
But then this notion of a Black internationalism is very interesting as well, because a lot of times, to be honest with you, an academic, and the reason why it's important to trace and the reason why I wanted you to really look at this is that what we're really actually always going back to, even in an international context, as Kwame Ture would say, is Africa's always at the center of it, right?
Right.
So at the center
right.
of it, the work is really looking back to constructing an Africana world or an African world through not only intellectual engagement and relationships, but through resistance as well, but also how do we see a world beyond a colonial world? How do we see a world beyond a world that is rooted in a racial capitalist oppressive forms of knowledge that filters into our everyday life? So what I wanted to do now is to take a quick pivot, because we want to kind of end this conversation. Due to time constraints, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Now Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Now Project. That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher, and content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent. We'll be right back.